There it is.
There you go.
Good evening. This is the Joint Committee on Public Safety. It's Wednesday, April 3rd, 2013. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3194. Tonight is public testimony, and just so we can have some context as to some of the ground rules, we have a lot of people signed up, I think probably anywhere from 35 to 40. It is my hope that we give everyone an opportunity to testify. And so this box here actually is a box that will, it's time for 3 minutes. And you will have a green light to go. Yellow light is caution, and red is stop. Testimony will continue over into Friday. There's been some discussion as to why tonight we're not including telephonic testimony. If time permits on Friday, that can occur. But tonight, we want to give those who have come to the Capitol and come here to testify the opportunity to do so. And with that, I think all the members are present, and here I will call up the, and I will call you by panels. And I will call the first panel, and I will also identify the next panel to come so that when they finish, then you can come right up, and that way we can get a good flow, and hopefully with that, everyone here will have an opportunity to testify, and your voices will be heard. And my first panel, I believe, is Judge Meisenheimer, Justice DeMunis, and John Hummel.
Madam Chair, while they're coming up, if I could just put on the record, Senator Betsy Close, who's part of our committee, is excused tonight. She's not able to be here. That is why she's not in attendance.
And the green on deck, the next on deck is Christine Landers, Mike Lavalle, I'm learning all these things.
And that's good.
And that's good. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon. Did you wish us to go any particular
order? I wish whichever order you would like to begin.
Okay, I'll do it. You pointed to me. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Paul DeMunez. I used to control a light like that in another courtroom, so I'll try not to violate it. I'm here as Nancy Campbell, a retired Washington County Circuit Court judge who has submitted written testimony, and it was requested that I would read her letter into the record. So I will do that now with the committee's permission. Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Campbell, and I'm a retired circuit court judge from Washington County, now living in Depot Bay, Oregon. I am providing this testimony to share my experience with State v. Rodriguez Buck, a case argued before the Oregon Supreme Court in 2008. This case was a consolidation of two individual cases, one from Washington County and the other from Marion County, which the Supreme Court considered simultaneously because their presenting issues were so similar. Both cases involved the charge of first-degree sexual abuse, which I understand is before you for consideration of sentencing modification. When Veronica Rodriguez was convicted of this crime in my court in 2007, I sentenced her to 16 months in prison, rather than the 75 months required by Measure 11. At no time in my judicial career did I take such an extraordinary measure. I felt my actions were warranted in this case due to the nature of Ms. Rodriguez's offense, and the Oregon Supreme Court agreed. I think what she means there is the Oregon Supreme Court affirmed her sentence. It is never pleasant to discuss crimes, particularly those involving sexual abuse. In over 20 years on the bench, I saw a wide range of cases, some of which were horrific and warranted long sentences the defendants received. The Rodriguez case was different. This case involved a young and, I think, immature teacher who took a 12-year-old student under her wing. Ms. Rodriguez worked at the Boys and Girls Club with at-risk youth. She took special care of this particular child, driving him to school and offering support and attention outside the classroom. She clearly overstepped professional boundaries with this child and violated the rules of her employer. Ms. Rodriguez was convicted for standing behind this child in a room with 30 to 50 other people and holding his head to her chest while patting his head for approximately 1 minute. A jury found that she had done this for sexual gratification and that she was therefore guilty of sexual abuse in the first degree. Under Measure 11, the mandatory sentence for sexual abuse one is 6 years and 3 months. During my time on the bench, I saw a range of cases. Some, as I said earlier, clearly warranted a lengthy sentence, but others seem to deserve greater attention to the individual circumstances of the crime. Am I getting close to my time?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'll give him some of mine.
Yield. Yeah.
Yield.
Should I stop? You have it in the record. I don't want to violate anyone else's time, so I will say one sentence. She said, in conclusion, I strongly urge you to modify Measure 11 to provide for sentencing discretion that would allow a judge to take into consideration the facts of the case, the criminal history of the defendant, and other mitigating and aggravating factors.
That's a long sentence.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your indulgence.
All right. In the interest of getting on with it, may it please the Joint Committee on Public Safety. My name is Keith Meisenheimer. I'm a retired Multnomah County Circuit Court judge and served between 1999 and 2011. For the 23 years prior to that, I was a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, handling primarily crimes of violence where the victims were both adults and children, and of course including all these crimes that are before the committee. I was asked to testify concerning my views on the proposal to remove these crimes from the mandatory provisions of Measure 11, and I'm happy to do that with the understanding that some of my perspective is dated because it dates from prior to 1999. I should also mention that I have particularly extensive experience in prosecuting child sex abuse. I was one of the professionals in Multnomah County that founded the CARES program based on a perception that we needed more accurate and sensitive assessment of children when they were suspected victims. With respect to the particular issues before this committee on these three crimes, I think the highest priority in criminal sentencing is public protection. First and foremost, this means prevention of reoffense by the particular defendant, achieved through incarceration, supervision in the community, and or requiring the defendant to participate in reformation slash treatment programs. Community protection is also achieved to the extent the sentence acts as a deterrent to others. The sentence and the process by which the sentence is reached must also serve other important values, including comporting with a sense of justice in that the sentence is proportionate to the seriousness of the offense and damage caused, and that the victim's interests and views have been respected and given appropriate weight. My general concern with ballot measure 11 is that we have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in expanding prison capacity and operating prisons since its inception. I personally believe, having spent hundreds of hours with the victims of terrible crimes and their families, that prevention is about 1,000 times more valuable than an appropriate response from the criminal justice system. And I would like to see us investing in Boys and Girls Clubs and that type of effective program rather than ballot measure 11. But with respect to these particular crimes, it's my sense that the mandatory sentences are overbroad. They include many offenders who may have minor records or first-time offenders who could be appropriately sentenced and handled without danger to the public protection in local community programs. I also am concerned that this mandatory approach is disrespectful of these victims, because as a prosecutor, when I was handling these cases prior to ballot measure 11, I could tell a victim who had a relationship with the offender, perhaps a grandfather, perhaps an uncle, how you feel about what happens is important. I'm not sure that a prosecutor today can say that because the sentence is mandatory. But many of these victims that I dealt with wanted the offender to get treatment, not go to prison. And so let me conclude.
Your time's up,
Let
Your
me conclude
Honor.
By just saying I do support removing them from the mandatory.
And, Your Honor, if you have written testimony, can we have that for the
I
record?
I believe it's been sent in with one grammatical error, which I just observed. And I'm also, I also must say, if any the committee ever has any questions about the Veronica Rodriguez case, I've read the transcripts and the police reports. I believe she's innocent of any crime.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is John Hummel. I'm the state and federal policy director for the Oregon Primary Care Association. On behalf of OPCA and HISCO, the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, I respectfully request your support of the Oregon Public Safety Package. HISCO is a coalition of 120 organizations and individuals founded in 1985 with the goal of establishing a place for collaboration, partnership, and dialogue between health, housing, and human service providers. OPCA, a HISCO member, is a nonprofit membership organization comprising Oregon's 31 community health centers that operate 201 health clinics statewide. Our member health centers provide coordinated care to 330,000 rural and/or medically underserved patients annually. Our patients are primarily uninsured or on Medicaid. HISCO and OPCA have been full participants in Oregon's recent health transformation efforts. Through the leadership of the governor and members of the Legislative Assembly, Oregon is showing the country how innovation, community empowerment, fiscal discipline, and a focus on outcomes can positively change the status quo and build healthy communities. We used to spend our time, money, and effort focusing on health care. To what end? Focusing on health care produced more health care. Do we want more health care? No. We want better health. With this understanding, you and your colleagues created a coordinated care organization model that decentralized state dollars to local communities, empowering them to improve health outcomes. This same philosophy should be applied to public safety. We have historically spent our time, money, and effort focusing on prosecution and incarceration. To what end? Focusing on prosecution and incarceration produces more prosecution and incarceration. Do we want more prosecution and incarceration, or do we want to improve public safety so there is less crime to begin with and thus fewer criminals to prosecute and incarcerate? Redirecting a portion of our prison budget to community corrections and to addiction and mental health treatment programs will produce less crime, which is what we all want. Community safety should be the goal. House Bill 3194 helps us achieve it. Please vote yes on House Bill 3194, and let's once again show the country how we do things differently here in Oregon. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Your Honors, and thank you, Mr. Humble. And will the next group come forward? And on deck is Kiki Parker, Rose, Doug Cooper, and Paul Solomon.
Paul, you're in the next group.
You're in the next group.
Yes.
Good evening, Co-Chair, Senator Winters, and the rest of the Public Safety Committee. I am Christine Lander. I'm a Deputy District Attorney.
Could you speak into the mic, please?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I am a Senior Deputy District Attorney for Clackamas County. I have been a Deputy District Attorney for about, 16 years at this point, primarily prosecuting person-to-person felonies for about the last 10 years. I'm going to introduce Mr. Lavallier as well before I make my remarks. He is a crime victim in a currently pending case that I am prosecuting. He has graciously agreed to come down here and talk to you about this bill. So I want to start with a little bit of an intro, and I probably won't take up the entire amount of time you have allotted to me, and just mention something that I'm not sure if you have heard or has been sort of discussed by anyone who's testified before you before related specifically to sex abuse in the first degree. I am a prosecutor. I do engage in plea negotiations related to many crimes, including Jessica's law offenses. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but one of the things that I think is important for the committee to understand is that we will frequently plead 300-month sentences through the plea negotiation process using sex abuse in the first degree as a charge that gets us underneath the 300-month sentence, but generally above the 75-month sentence. I raise that because I didn't intentionally eavesdrop, but I did hear someone who is probably going to be talking about sex abuse, one, charges being a primary driver of prison beds. And one of the reasons for that could be because of individuals like Christopher Anderson, who is a man I prosecuted for raping a little girl repeatedly. It was a mandatory minimum 300-month sentence. He had charges in Clackamas County and in Deschutes County. He ultimately pled guilty to several sex abuse ones in Clackamas County and a number of other charges in Deschutes County and got a 40-year sentence. Very, very serious crime. But if people like Mr. Anderson are being sort of unwittingly included in your concerns about the amount of money being spent on sex abuse one beds, it's a bit misleading, not intentionally, I'm sure, because he's not a sex abuse one offender. Now, Mr. Lavallier is here. He is the crime victim in a case that is currently indicted. The defendant is charged with sex abuse in the first degree, burglary in the first degree. It is alleged to have occurred in November. His daughter's friend, who was 16 years of age at the time, is the alleged victim in the sex abuse in that case. This was a home invasion burglary. I'm not going to say anything more about the facts because it is a pending case, and all of what I've told you is in the public record, but Mr. Lavallier would like to also speak to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm not quite sure where to
begin. Mr. Valley, would you state your name for the record, please?
Michael Lavallier.
Thank you.
There are many ways to address this issue. I'll try to stick with the facts. When you have young children and they're home safe with their families in the middle of the night, and you have someone who obsesses over that young child, in this case my daughter, it's wrong. And it's not safe to have people like this out on the streets. I think we can all agree to that fact. The issue here has to do with individuals that commit these sex abuse one crimes. And I have to wonder, for each case that comes to court where someone is convicted, how many other sex abuse one events have occurred where the families, because of the trauma, have declined to pursue it. I don't have any facts on that, but I suspect the numbers are alarming. So if we want to reduce crime here in the state of Oregon, we need to convey a message that these kinds of crimes are not to be tolerated. In this case, my daughter was home during the day studying at a front window, and this gentleman was across the street. And I have to surmise that he obsessed over her and chose to break into our home in the middle of the night, not realizing that she had a friend staying over. And thank God there were two of them in the bedroom together, or who knows what might have happened. So this is the kind of event that I'm sure everyone here wants to prevent. And I wonder how many of these crimes are repeated toward other innocent children. We've got to stop this. We've got to send a message out to the whole state that this sort of thing cannot be tolerated. If personally, my daughter and her friend do not feel safe. Before, we didn't set an alarm, a burglar alarm. Now she asks me every night, have I set the alarm? That's crazy. What kind of a life is that? The unknown, the trauma that occurs with these families is beyond description. And we shouldn't be just concerned about the well-being of the criminal. We should be more concerned about the innocent families that are affected by these criminals. Does anybody have any questions for me?
Questions?
Just one really quick question, Madam Chair.
And
I know you're where you're at in your prosecution process of it. Is there history on this individual?
I wish I could answer that, but I really don't think it's appropriate for me to answer that question.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Roland, did you have a question?
No.
Thank you very much for coming and sharing with us.
That's your question.
That's your question.
Yeah, I did.
We hear you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. There's got to be.
On deck, but I want the on deck group because Kiki. On deck is Michael Reagan and Emily Wood. Kiki, are you going to start?
I am going to start. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Kiki Park-Rose, and I'm the director of Klamath County Community Corrections. I'm here today to testify in support of Oregon Public Safety Package, House Bill 3194. I'm honored today to be testifying with two of the many partners Community Corrections has the opportunity to collaborate with in our efforts to improve public safety. Doug Cooper with Mercy Corps Northwest in Multnomah County, and Paul Solomon with sponsors in Lane County. Our agencies receive funding from the Criminal Justice Commission to provide reentry services in our respective counties. In 2007, our county operated a prisoner reentry program. We brought inmates back to the community corrections work release center 6 months prior to their release from prison. The reentry program provided interventions to these offenders, including alcohol and drug treatment, batters program, job placement, and educational services. These programs protected public safety by allowing offenders to transition back into the community with appropriate tools necessary to be successful. Before the new program began, Klamath County resident Jimmy was in and out of prison, put this down, 9 times for most of his adult life, each time failing back into old habits of addiction and crime. But in 2009, after serving a sentence for theft and burglary, he was placed in the transition program before being released into the community. Rather than a startling adjustment from the structured prison environment, he was able to go into the transition program to help him reenter society. By working collaboratively with our community partners, this time his transition was successful. Today, he's a drug and alcohol counselor helping addicts turn their lives around. Jimmy's story is not unique. During the 4 years the program was in place, 84% of the offenders successfully completed it, and 100% were successfully placed in clean and sober housing. Despite initial promising results, budget cuts forced Klamath County to end the transition program in 2011. Klamath County is not exclusive in the difficulties we've had over the last few years. The reduction of grant and aid funds in 2011-2013 budget resulted in our department eliminating correction staff, contracts with service providers, contracts that provided services to victims and children of our offenders, sex offender services, alcohol and drug treatment services, and batterers programs. Not only did community corrections experience the reductions were also felt by the many community partners in our area, who we can no longer fund to provide the valuable services needed to assist us with changing offender behavior. House Bill 3194 gives Oregon the opportunity to invest in strategies that work in holding offenders accountable while changing offender behavior. This investment allows local systems to take a holistic approach to public safety by investing in victim services, addiction programs, mental health programs, reentry services, and local law enforcement. We've realized that we can't build our way out of crime with more and more prisons. If we're serious about public safety, we have to break the cycle of crime and addiction. I'm short on time. House Bill 3194 allows us to continue to invest in successful programs. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Members of the committee, thank you for hearing us this evening. My name is Doug Cooper. I'm the Assistant Director at Mercy Corps Northwest, and I'm the Project Co-Director of the Reentry Transition Center in Multnomah County. We're in strong support of HB 3194, including the modest reforms on Measure 11, because we believe it's sound public policy. These additional resources that are generated for community-based public safety programs will help rebuild some of the services that have been reduced over the last decade, and it will help create a benevolent cycle of effective intervention, increased reentry success, and less use of criminal justice resources. The results of this are increased public safety and a reduction of taxpayer dollars spent on incarceration. Mercy Corps Northwest runs one of the three grant-funded reentry resource centers that are represented here. The Transition Center in Portland opened in September of 2009 with funding initially from the United Way and six other community partners. The Transition Center then received additional funding through a Justice Assistance Burn Grant, along with the other programs for you today. And it was administered by the Criminal Justice Commission. It was originally a two-year grant. We've extended an additional 18 months at a no-cost extension, and we've met every benchmark and goal set for the project. It operates by providing support to individuals leaving county jail, state, or federal prison. And like Klamath Falls, we coordinate the services over 22 community partner agencies in support of these people that are trying to rebuild their lives and reenter the community successfully. We work in cooperation with Multnomah County, DCJ, the parole officers, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and U.S. Probation and Parole. As of December 2012, the RTC in Portland had served over 2,000 people. We'd provide 1,108 with transportation to help look for employment or referral appointments. We had helped 580 with birth certificates, state ID, or licenses necessary for employment. We helped 357 find work. We provided over 33,000 individual check-ins to our clients. We made 1,017 referrals to partner agencies. And we recruited over 4,000 hours of community volunteer help in support of these individuals. The results were described in the 2013 evaluation by the Criminal Justice Commission that was revised in March. That evaluation found that for every reduced overall rearrest rates by 31% and provided a $14 return for every dollar invested in the project. By consistently supporting these community-based programs like ours, which are not unique, we have other partner agencies in Multnomah County, including Volunteers of America, Central City Concern, Center for Family Success, Phoenix Rising Transition. By consistently supporting these organizations, these projects pay for themselves many times over, both in tax dollars saved and in lives rebuilt. We believe it's sound public policy to invest.
Thank you. I was in a hurry to get up here, and I'm going to do my darndest to get through my testimony in my 3 minutes. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Paul Solomon, and I'm the executive director at Sponsors in Eugene. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3194. Sponsors has been providing reentry services in Lane County since 1973. We've been a leader in the implementation of evidence-based practices. In 2010, we opened a new 72-bed facility that is seen as a model for transitional housing in Oregon. This facility also houses our Burn Grant CJC-funded Reentry Resource Center. As Doug and Kiki have described, the Reentry Resource Centers are one example of collaborative, community-based programs that are cost-effective and make our community safer. In addition, Sponsors has put together a range of programs based on research and best practices that focus on the people at highest risk to reoffend and provide programming designed to address their needs and mitigate risk factors. I believe that the reforms to Measure 11 and Measure 57 are needed to balance our public safety priorities and reinvest the savings in community corrections-based programs like reentry services, drug treatment, cognitive behavioral therapy, and parole and probation. I also believe that we can still hold people accountable while making modest reductions to their length of sentence. I would actually like to see us go even further, offering earned time to people sentenced under Measure 11. Ultimately, we should be very concerned with whether or not we're able to provide the treatment and interventions that will decrease the likelihood of people reoffending when they get out. When these people succeed, they become tax-paying, law-abiding members of our community. When they fail, they create new victims and drive criminal justice costs at every juncture of the system at great taxpayer expense. I also believe that the public safety reinvestment portion of 3194 has the potential to represent a much-needed shift, moving precious public safety funding from the state to the counties. Lane County's public safety system is on the verge of collapse. Decreased community corrections funding, coupled with the loss of federal timber subsidies, have created a real public safety emergency. We have disproportionately invested in our state prison system at the expense of funding for state police, victim services, and community corrections. We have a much better opportunity to provide meaningful interventions at the local level that will keep people out of prison with proper funding. These more effective and efficient local control options need to be made as robust as possible as part of the reinvestment from state correction savings. Finally, if we don't pass House Bill 3194, more money will be directed to DOC to pay for more prison beds at the expense of other important public safety services. Thank you for allowing us to testify today, and I urge you to support House Bill 3194.
Thank you, and thank you, Kiki, for taking the long drive up from Klamath Falls.
Indeed.
On deck is Christina McMahon, Don Lincoln, and Roy Washington.
Who's up now?
Up now is Michael Reagan and Emily Wood.
May she come with her mother?
Sure.
Ready? Yep. Co-chairs, yeah. Members of the committee, my name is Michael Reagan. I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Clackamas County. I am a trier of cases as well as a supervisor of veteran prosecutors who do exclusively this kind of work. I'm Christine Lander's supervisor. I am here with Emily Wood. I don't think Emily Wood is going to be able to talk today because she's still traumatized over 15 years after her victimization. I didn't expect that. I'm shocked all the time at how victimization lives with you your entire life. I am a career prosecutor. I'm never comfortable being in a political situation where there's yes, no, us against them. We are not stupid. We have discretion. We use our discretion. Discretion has to be somewhere. It's with judges. It's with prosecutors. We see ballot measure 11 as a privilege. We do not see the case in Washington County that Justice Dominguez referenced as a good thing. It's an aberration. It's a shame. We're conscious of that every day. And we don't file a lot of cases. We low file a lot of cases. We come out of ballot measure 11 more than we stay in. I think there's a gross misunderstanding as to a prosecutor who's a career prosecutor's discretion and the burden that we feel to make sure that we do the right thing. Prisons in Oregon are filled with the violent, the predatory, and the people that deserve to be there. Emily Wood's grandfather is one of those people. I want Emily Wood to be able to talk about it. She's 25 years old now. When she was 5 to 13, her grandfather, who she loved and still loves to this day, knew she was a bedwetter and would wake her in the night whenever she was there, hundreds of times over these 5 years, and make her walk him down the hallway from the bedroom to the bathroom. She would stand in front, he would stand behind, and he would make her take her little 5-year-old hand and place it on his penis around it. Not on it, but around it. And then he would grab his hand and put it on top. And he would do this on the way down the hall and on the way back, night after night, month after month, year after year. This is the kind of sex abuse in the first degree that we file every day. This is the representative type of case we see every day, not the case that you've heard about from Washington County. That is a definite aberration. This case is representative. We didn't bring Emily here because this is some grandiose case that, oh my God, we want to make an impression with. I see all these cases. They all come across my desk. This is a routine case. when she was 5 to 13, this is what her grandfather did. It was because of ballot measure 11 that we were able to get a sentence of 18 and 3/4 years. If we did not have ballot measure 11, the sentence would have been less. I don't know how much less. It would have been under Oregon sentencing guidelines, but it clearly would have been less, about half probably. And the other thing I want to say before my time runs out is I think that it's dangerous to start just picking out cases and thinking that that will affect the prison population, because right now we don't file everything we have. If we have serious cases, we'll just file more counts to get more time perhaps, because we are, as I agree with what Ms. Lander said, we routinely bring things down and use sex abuse one as a hold, a carry-all for all much more serious cases. My time's run out. I apologize. Emily broke down in the hallway outside, and I'm not going to put her through that. I'm going to ask her mother to speak on her behalf. Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chairs and Ms. and Ms. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Teresa McCart. I am Emily's mother. The things that happened to her will never go away. I was the one that picked up the phone and prosecuted my father for what he did to my daughter. I don't regret that. I don't regret the time that he has to be there. He's hurt our family. He's hurt us tremendously. The things that he's done to my daughter, and I've seen her nightmares, and I've seen her tears, and it doesn't go away. She's scarred for life. This is something that affects our family. It doesn't just affect me or my father or my daughter, but it affects so many people around us. And we like to think this world is a better place because my father's in prison right now for what he did to my daughter. And my daughter's not going to get over this. This is not something that goes away. She's been in counseling. I've had her through a lot of things, but it's still there. It's still very at the surface. And so we would just really like to have you guys consider this and keep Measure 11 the way it is. We think it's a very good thing.
Talk about yourself.
For myself, I grew up in the home with my father. My father sexually abused me. I was sexually abused by him from the time that I was 11 years old until I was 15. You might ask how I can go on and let my daughter go there. I didn't know all the things I know about sex offenders now. I didn't know that they were always going to be sex offenders. I got to the point where I forgave my dad for what he did for me, the hardest thing I've ever done. But I felt like in order to forgive him, I had to trust him with my kids. And my dad was a big influence in that, in persuading me for that. So I did trust him with my kids, and I watched him all the time. My kids knew that I had been sexually abused, but they had no idea it was my father that did it, because I never told them. When I talked to them, some circumstances in our lives had changed, and I had to sit my kids down and explain to them who it was that had touched me growing up. When that happened, my daughter said, I hadn't even told them. I just said, I need to talk to you. My daughter said, I know who it was, Mom. It was Grandpa, because he touched me too. I knew right then that it was no longer about me and what I had gone through, but it was about my daughter, and I had to help her. And my mom was not there for me. She did not help me through all these things, but I could not be that same mother to my daughter. And so my dad was prosecuted because what he did to us both is just not okay, and it needs to be stopped. And these people that aren't stopping, they need to be punished. And I don't regret having my father in prison. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck is Bracken McKee.
Co-chairs, committee members, Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Christina McMahon. I am an assistant director in the Department of Community Justice in Multnomah County, overseeing the Juvenile Services Division. I have worked in the public safety arena in four different counties in Oregon, serving as a deputy district attorney in Marion County and also in Deschutes County, and then becoming juvenile director in Douglas County and now in juvenile division director in Multnomah County. I have a very strong value in accountability to victims in our community, and I have deep respect for the people that just testified and shared what they did with us. But I also have as an equal belief that people really are able to make positive changes. Not all people, but most people, and a significant portion of the people that we deal with in the system. I am here to testify in support of House Bill 3194 on behalf of the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. We supervise both adult and juvenile offenders. We believe House Bill 3194 makes sense because it provides a balanced approach to public safety in Oregon, and by balanced, one that ensures that people are still held accountable, but also one that prioritizes giving people an opportunity to change and become contributing members of our community rather than deficits. Specifically, we support the reduction in prison terms for assault in the second degree, robbery in the second degree, and sex abuse in the first degree, because of the wide range of behaviors that those crimes encompass. There are different proposals on how that range of behavior could be addressed, and we believe that that range still provides the accountability that is needed for those crimes. We also strongly support earned review or second look for youth offenders. I know you've heard me testify about this before, but I think there's some confusion about what second look means. Second look means that a youth offender has an opportunity to be heard in court along with everyone else who has a stake in the matter, the prosecutor, the victims, treatment providers, et cetera. It's not an automatic, it's not a default that they will get out of a youth correctional facility. It's an opportunity to convince a judge by meeting statutory criteria that they deserve an opportunity to be conditionally released. In Multnomah County, and I know this is such an important thing in our community, and I know I've talked to you about this before, but I believe it really bears repeating. The impact of Measure 11 in our community, specifically when it comes to youth, has been profound. When you look at who is sitting in youth correctional facility beds, either on Measure 11 or waived adult charges, approximately one-third of them, of those people on any given day, are youth from Multnomah County. In 2012, we had 101 youth who were convicted under Measure 11 or waived at the adult. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to turn it over. I'm very honored to have two of my coworkers.
Before you
me.
Do, Representative Garrett.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a very quick clarifying comment since you referred to this bill as being a reduction in prison sentences. It's really a replacement of the mandatory minimum with a range, and that range right. means that some people could get the same sentence they get today under Measure 11 or something greater. So I want everybody to understand that. We're not talking about shortening all sentences by any means. We're talking about replacing a minimum with a range and discretion.
Yes, thank you. You said that much better than I did, so I appreciate you clarifying that. I'm going to turn this over now to two of my coworkers from Multnomah County.
Co-chairs and committee, my name is Don Lincoln, and I'm a custody service manager for Multnomah County Juvenile Justice. I've worked with Multnomah County for the last 22 and a half years, close soon to be 23 years, and I've worked in custody my entire career with Multnomah County. And I work directly with the Measure 11 youth that come into our facility, those that are the actual perpetrators as well as those that were along for the ride. And so I've seen the ups and the downs of the Measure 11 youth that come to our facility as well as those that come in our community. And so I see kids that have fallen off the charts in the education field and haven't been able to be given the the type of education and the opportunities that normal kids would be. And I say normal because large percentage of our youth that come into our system have additional mental health issues that they bring to our facility and that they carry from day to day. And it's basically from a range of things that have occurred in their lives over the years and where they come from. And so I've seen this go on for, like I said, for this length of time that I've worked with Multnomah County. I am in favor for this bill, and I can see how it would help those that are coming out of the system to have opportunities to have employment and to be able to seek whatever needed services that they have. We know that once they've been labeled, that's really, really difficult. So there has to be some kind of system or additional programming that will allow them to come back and be productive members of in our community, which I have seen repeatedly over my 23-year time frame there. I've ran into youth in our community, in the stores, and been greeted very kindly and encouraged to continue to do what I do. So I know that they have learned something and they've made some changes in their lives. They're capable, very capable of doing that. And so I really do would appreciate also that you would really, truly consider this bill in the way that would allow these young men and women to come back and be a part of their communities. Thank you. Any questions?
My name is Roy Washington, and I'm afraid. I support the House bill of 3194. I've worked in our community for over 43 years. I've worked with the Portland Police Department with the crisis response as a volunteer, and I'm currently working with Multnomah County, which I've been there for also 17 years. I work directly with the kids in the facility. The values that I live by is family, community, accountability, and justice. I believe justice should be served to any means necessary, but also see the face of the kids when they do come into the facility, especially the first-time offenders. They look like a fish out of water. And some of the offenders, they come in and they're used to the system. And for those that are first-time offenders, you know, someone gave me a second chance. I had a new opportunity at one time, and I really appreciated that because I was able to be successful out of it. And I see where other youth that come into the facility that would do the same if they had a opportunity. And some kids that come into the facility, they come in, you know, and they still try to beat the facility or find a quick way to get around situations. But those that would like another chance, those kids are there in school, that's playing sports and doing opportunities and doing things for themselves. You know, I think there should be an opportunity for them to have another chance, another opportunity. And so, you know, I also feel that the judges should have a say-so in the situation whenever a kid is placed upon trial. And so, you know, I just think that a change in the system should take place for 3194 because it will really benefit and it would save money. I mean, each bill, each time we come to the table or each time someone comes into detention, it costs us a lot of money. And taxpayers are paying for it. And those kids that are first-time offenders, you know, if we gave them an opportunity to go back to school and get a job or maybe do what's right, you know, that's money to be saved. I see we're closing schools and we're building prisons. And that's sending another message to our kids. And so, you know, I'm in support of a Bill 3194. If you have any questions, I will be obliged to answer them.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you so very much. On deck is Pat Lee Katz, Gretchen Valla, and Karen James. Who's up now? Bracken McKee. I won't skip. I'm going to skip Ryan because he's been sitting.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bracken McKee. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with the Washington County DA's office. I'm also a father of two children, and I'm asking you to keep one of the few areas of government that is working exactly as it should intact. Oregonians are safer, dramatically safer now than they were when Measure 11 was put into place. I want to talk tonight about Get Ty Lamb. Miss Lamb was 83 years old, 100 pounds dripping wet, and stood in at 4'11" back on March 12 of 2008. That's a date she's never going to forget, because that night when she was sound asleep in her home, in her master bedroom on the second floor of her home in Bethany, which is north of West Union in Washington County, a car pulled up outside and two men wearing ski masks got out. The two men went around to the back of the house and they found a window that was unlatched. They pried the window open and they went upstairs with flashlights and some rope to the second story. And they kicked in her master bedroom door, which she had kept locked. She lived there alone. And put flashlights in her eyes and ordered her out of bed into the bathroom. They then used the rope to secure the bathroom door by tying the doorknob with one end and securing the other end of the rope to the banister. They then ransacked the house and stole more than $50,000 in property, including a 300-pound safe that they found in the master bedroom closet. But the problem was they didn't have a key for the safe. And that's when one of the defendants who was 10 days shy of his 18th birthday, a defendant who had planned, premeditated this robbery over dinner at Sherry's earlier, said, "I have an idea." And he went downstairs and he got a steak knife out of the kitchen, went back up, undid the door, and put the knife to the victim, demanding to know where the key was. Ms. Lamb does not speak English. This was the most terrifying event imaginable. And the two made off with the 300-pound safe, got it into the car, and would have been successful in their getaway, except a few days later, the getaway driver talked. He talked to a buddy who then told a friend who had a father who was a Washington County officer. Now, what separates this case from any other robbery case, burglary case, and kidnapping case? Not much, except that the person 10 days shy of his 18th birthday was Brian Van Pham, who testified a week ago this last Friday about a mistake he made when he was almost 18. And I'm here to tell you this wasn't a mistake. This was a premeditated, selfish act. And it's important for the record to reflect that. I thank you for your time. I see my time is up. I was also asked by Marnie Leavenworth, who was a victim who's now in Utah, to testify and be her voice. She wanted to testify telephonically.
And I think I explained why we didn't have telephonics tonight. And on Friday, if there is time available, I have talked to both, I think correspondent has been with both D.A. Foote and Doug Hargrow and everyone who had raised that issue, so that the opportunity may avail itself on Friday.
Thank you very much.
And I'm sure.
Written testimony,
yes.
Too.
Written testimony would really help.
Just one real quick question. Okay, what I heard you describe in that Lamb case was that you had burglary first degree.
Yes.
You had kidnapping first degree.
Kidnapping in the second degree and robbery in the first degree.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Matthews.
Thank you. And since we named the suspect by name and he did testify, and since we have a full room, we should probably also note that Mr. Pham, on his 23rd birthday, testified, and he is since now making something of his life. He has an associate's degree, working towards a bachelor's, and he's still incarcerated. He's still held responsible. But I want to point out, too, because it's not mentioned, but it's in the same article with a lot of the information that you gave us, and that is that the family actually urged leniency for the three teens who pled guilty because that's just the kind of people they were.
You know, I spoke with them this last week, and not only did this dramatically impact the life of the 83-year-old who's now 89, but it impacted the entire family's life because she can't be alone even for a second. And she talked about this cultural fear that they had with asking for somebody to go to prison and what that might mean for their family. Because she can't be alone for a second, Representative Matthews, her daughter and her family had to move in with her. And when they're not available because of work, the rest of the family has to coordinate and take turns taking care of grandma because she literally can't be alone. So, you know, when I was up looking for their house in Bethany, they live on a street called Banff, and there's actually six sections of Banff, and I got lost, and I was about a mile off. And I ended up knocking on a door and introduced myself to this middle-aged couple, and I said, I'm looking for an 89-year-old Vietnamese woman. And she's about 4'11", and I think she lives right around here. And they said, she doesn't. She lives about a mile off. And they told me where, but they said, she's the woman who was a victim of a home invasion robbery, wasn't she? And I said, yeah, how'd you know? And she said, everybody in our community knows. We talked about it at homeowners association meetings, and this impacted the sense of safety and security of all of us. So, you know, the one person who had control of the decision that night was Mr. Brian Van Pham. And, he's
Mr. McKay,
paying the price.
Mr. McKay, I want to be able to hear everybody, so, and we want to
thank
hear.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, that's fine. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's on deck is David, and I hope I don't mess up your name, David. Sathabar, and Ryan Deckard, and John Carter.
Good evening, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Valla, and I'm the president of Oregon Cure, which is a state chapter of National Cure. Our advocacy work in Oregon is working with the Department of Corrections, and we facilitate, we facilitate intake orientations for family members who have a loved one going into the prison system, and we explain what the incarceration period will be like. We also work with community corrections in Multnomah, Clackamas, Marion, and Washington counties, and co-facilitate reentry orientations for family members so they can understand what the terms and conditions of post-prison supervision are. So. Oregon Cure fully supports House Bill 3194. On National Cure, 4 years ago, prepared a position paper on sentencing, and we fully believe that states should develop comprehensive and restorative sentencing options, including but not limited to diversion from prison programs, community corrections programs with alcohol and drug treatment, education, mental health services, job skills development and placement, and post-release assistance. Community corrections legislation needs to be enacted that financially supports this plan and provides incentives to counties to divert a segment of the prison population to community corrections. The use of alternative justice methods will reduce prison and jail costs, hold people accountable for their crimes, and without compromising public safety, help people with criminal convictions successfully reintegrate into the community. Now, I appreciate everything that everyone said here tonight, but I think one of the most important things is that Governor Kitzhaber carefully chose the people who served on the Commission on Public Safety. I ask that you just as carefully consider the options set forth by the Commission which would halt the projected growth in the prison population and save taxpayers $600 million over the next 10 years. And what I would like to leave you with is my youngest son is in prison. He's been in for 8 years. Well, his first 8 years was under a Measure 11 charge, and I shared this with you, Representative Garrett, a few weeks ago. And during his first 8 years while he was serving his Measure 11 sentence, he didn't really embrace the prison experience. He spent about half of his time in segregation. Lo and behold, this last February, he has a consecutive sentence. He's in the second term, and he will earn time. He's taken a Spanish class. He's in the business construction technology. He's asked to move into privileged housing, and his whole attitude has changed. Does that make a difference? Does earn time make a difference? I think so. Thank you very much for your time.
Good evening, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Patty Katz, and I'm here today to talk about House Bill 3194. I work for Oregon Action. We're a statewide, broad-based, multiracial community organization dedicated to economic justice. We work to build concrete and lasting political power for our members. In addition, I'm on the steering committee for ROAR, Reentry Organizations and Resources. ROAR is a collaborative of over 50 nonprofits, faith-based, and government agencies to promote greater awareness of reentry issues in the community. Last year, my office was located at Mercy Corps Northwest Reentry Transition Center. Hundreds of people came to the RTC from prison or jail. I saw firsthand the need for programs to help people become successful as they reenter the community. Many folks were able to return to work, reunite with their families, go to school, pay their fines, and restitution for the victims of their crimes. We need to get smart on crime by reinvesting a portion of correction savings generated by reforms into victim services, addiction treatment, and reentry programs. Making sure we have strong public safety systems, creating safe and strong communities where we all want to live. When it comes to reentry, I have firsthand experience. I'm a formerly incarcerated person in long-term recovery. Oh, that made me emotional. Which means I haven't used drugs or alcohol in more than 13 years. I stopped hurting my family and stopped breaking the law, and I became a productive member of society. I know firsthand how the disease of addiction affected my behaviors. I disappointed my family. I disappointed myself. I didn't know there were 20 million people suffering from addiction in the United States. I didn't know how to stop using drugs. I thought it was a moral issue and not a treatable disease. The last time those doors closed behind me, I was relieved that my behaviors were going to be interrupted. While I was incarcerated, I was able to access drug treatment and a place to stay as I reentered the community. I'm here to ask you to make smart decisions on how we spend our valuable resources. We can improve public safety system by emphasizing cost-effective and evidence-based programs. The dollars we save by reasonable sentencing will allow for reinvestment of public safety dollars. Because of the resources that were in place for me, I'm a productive member of society today. I'm asking as we spend our resources, we remember that people are our resources too. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
You've got the mic.
That's fine.
I have one. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Karen James, and I am testifying in support of the Oregon Public Safety Package, House Bill 3194. According to the Oregon Department of Corrections, over half of the Oregon prisoners have a mental or emotional disorder, and many also have an addiction. The natural history of these diseases often leads to behaviors that result in incarceration. My son is duly diagnosed, which means he has a mental illness as well as an addiction. He committed a Measure 11 crime, robbery 2, and was sentenced to 60 months in prison.
Prison only exacerbated his condition, and he served the last 2 years of a sentence in the Oregon State Penitentiary Mental Health Infirmary. I agree with the Commission's recommendation to redirect funds to diversion courts, reentry, and community-based services. I also agree with the Commission's recommendation that sentences should be reduced and judicial discretion allowed for some Measure 11 crimes. Had a judge been allowed discretion in my son's case, he may have taken his mental state into account with a less severe sentencing outcome. A judge may have sentenced my son to a diversion court, allowing him to remain in the community, hold him accountable for his crime, mandate mental health treatment, and allowed continued support of his family and community-based services. Instead, Oregon spent $30,000 per year for a total of $180,000 for him to just sit in prison. But my son is now in the community, post-prison supervision mandates, medication, and treatment. He receives support from his family. He's doing okay. But DOC is ill-equipped to safely and effectively transition people with mental illness out of the prison system. Only through my relentless, time-consuming advocacy was my son released with services in place in the community. Others with mental illness who release from prison are not so lucky. They find themselves without medication once the prison's 30-day supply runs out, unable to help themselves, alone and often homeless. For this population, the continuum of care is crucial. Transitioning back to their communities after prison is difficult at best. But a change in routine for a person suffering from a mental disorder can cause regression, and a disruption in medication can be devastating. It's time to get smart on crime and reinvest some corrections reform generated funds into addiction, mental health treatment, diversion courts, and reentry programs. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. I urge your support for House Bill 3194.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. On deck is Sybil Hebb, Lindsay Nelson, and Jane Downing.
Good evening, Madam Chair.
Good evening.
Ryan Deckert, the president of the Oregon Business Association. We represent Oregon's, the broad swath of Oregon industry, from our Fortune 500 companies to many fine businesses across the state. I am privileged to be joined by John Carter, who is the chairman of the board of Schnitzer Steel, one of Oregon's finest companies, and David Zimbauer, a partner at Dun Kearney, who headed up and pulled the business community together to look at the data and the evidence. And listening to the testimony in the hearing, and I certainly don't envy the position that you're in, but I would take issue with the fine and good deputy district attorney from Washington County who just testified, who said this is the one area of state government that is working. And so from the business community point of view, we tried to take a broad and omnibus look at data and evidence around the country of what is working and what doesn't work. And I think that's been the great Oregon experiment, and certainly Washington is doing it as well, is we can, through the initiative process, decide what areas of state government ought to work and prescribe solutions through initiatives that solve those. Washington is a great experiment in this. They've got it right down to the class size, mandatory class sizes. I mean, we think, from our perspective, we could take a lot of the issues we're working on, from PERS reform to transportation projects, and run them through the initiative process. But frankly, that's what you're here gathered tonight to do, and we have a lot more faith in the legislative practice and process to look at the broad evidence, hear anecdotes and stories and factor those in, but also look at the data and look at the evidence and try to find the most cost-effective ways to keep our communities safe. And so that is the endeavor that David and John Carter has led the business community in, is to really take that broad look, and we are appreciative that you have put a joint committee, a bipartisan effort together that would take at least those seats, because I think it's the great Oregon tradition that looks at how do we solve problems big, broad problems legislatively, and we've put a lot of faith in that process, as messy as it is. And with that, I will hand it over to the chair of the Oregon Business Plan, representing Oregon industries across the state, John Carter.
Well, thanks for the introduction. Good evening to co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm actually here today to testify in support of the Oregon Public Safety Package, HB 3190.
For the record, would you state your name, please?
Yes, John Douglas Carter.
Thank you.
I'm here in my personal capacity as a member of Oregon's business community and, as Ryan mentioned, as current chair of the Oregon Business Plan Steering Committee, which I am sure you recognize as an effort driven by the business leaders of the state and its major business associations to help grow Oregon's economy. I'm also here as a born and raised in Pendleton, Oregon, Oregonian, as is my wife, my father. My grandparents were farmers in Pendleton, and my great-grandmother was born on a wagon train coming to Oregon. I do not purport to represent the views of any of the companies on whose boards I sit. I also have my own companies in business in Oregon, engaged in the wine business and the real estate business, but in the case of those businesses, I feel very comfortable representing their views. My purpose today is to support the legislative changes contained in HB 3194. My reasons for supporting those changes are very straightforward. The states that will succeed economically are those that invest wisely in their public sector. Businesses that invest in the wrong things or inefficiently can't compete as effectively. The same is true for states. When we spend on the wrong things, we divert resources from productive uses and increase the risk of more taxes on our people. That has major negative impacts on our ability to attract business, grow our economy, and create jobs that help prevent the types of unemployment and other factors that lead to criminal behavior. The effort here is part of the governor's overall and difficult effort to improve the delivery of health care, education, and employment retirement benefits, as well as corrections. Secondly, the proposals, as mentioned earlier, have been developed by the Governor's Commission on Public Safety and represent their analysis of what is needed to avoid the necessity of adding significantly to the capacity of Oregon's prison system within the next 10 years. Building a new prison is not, in my view, the ideal objective for our public safety system. If the legislature passes HB 3194, the estimated savings over the next 10 years could reach $600 million. For this state, that is significant. It is the reason that public safety reform is a part of the Oregon business plan. If we achieve those savings, some of the money can be redirected into public safety resources. From my standpoint, most importantly, into local law enforcement and victim services. The Governor's Commission has articulated a series of those strategies in directing funds to the Oregon State Police, local sheriff's departments, and community corrections departments would be much better prevention-oriented choices. Passing HB 3194 will assist us also in the effort to prevent a further tax burden on our taxpayers. There is another broad reason for supporting HB 3194. While there is no sentiment on my part to reduce the requirement that criminal behavior needs to be met with appropriate punishment, sending some types of nonviolent offenders into the prison system amounts to providing them with a graduate degree in criminal behavior. Far better to deter them and, if need be, punish them at the local level. Allowing local authorities and the judiciary more flexibility in tailoring the punishment to fit the crime should be more effective in deterring criminal behavior in the future. But to be clear, there's no intent on my part to encourage turning our attention away from criminal behavior or excusing it in any way. There are simply better ways to deal with some forms of crime than we are availing ourselves of, and we cannot afford, financially or from an effective policy standpoint, to treat all as violent, hardened criminals. Nearly 1 year ago.
Mr. Carter, I allowed you the extra 35, 40 minutes that Mr. Deckard did not use.
Minutes.
Seconds. Yeah. I mean seconds. Yeah,
I didn't realize I'd drawn on that long. I recommend support for HB 3194, and I urge the committee to move the package forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, and you're very close. My name is David Zentbauer. I am a corporate and real estate attorney, not a DA, not a defense attorney. And I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Business Association to testify in support of House Bill 3194. Leading up to tonight's testimony, I've vice-chaired the OBA's Good Government Committee, and I've sat on the Sound Budgeting Task Force, and we've been looking at this issue since at least 2011. And in that process, we've hosted a public meeting of the Commission on Public Safety, met with Commission Corrections Directors Williams and Peters, and we also met with DA Foote. And throughout that process, we've developed a set of guiding principles, which are set forth in the written testimony. And OBS supports this legislation because it encompasses those guiding principles. And I want to focus just on two of those. First, safe communities. OBA supports actions and programs that will continue the reduction of crime in Oregon. And OBA and its members require a safe environment for the conduct of our business, for our members, for our employees, our customers, and most importantly, our families. House Bill 3194 satisfies this important guiding principle by getting smart about how we punish, rehabilitate, and re-enter offenders into society to limit their opportunities or their recidivism. And it does so without cutting critical components of our public safety system. In fact, this legislation makes Oregon public safety system more effective from a policy and cost-saving standpoint by utilizing appropriate judicial discretion in sentencing, using cost-benefit and risk assessment tools in crafting sentences and reducing recidivism, and through the use of the most cost-effective and proven options, it keeps the intent of the mandatory minimum sentencing intact. The next of the OBA guiding principles to focus on is justice reinvestment. OBA supports the reinvestment of the avoided costs of increasing incarceration in these effective and evidence-based public safety programs. This will give the taxpayers the most effective use of their funds while continuing to reduce crime. In fact, HB 3194 represents the sound financial practices that successful Oregon businesses use. They find smart ways to cut costs and then reinvest those savings in products that will bring a return on our investment. And this legislation does just that. It finds savings through smart, evidence-based, cost-effective programs and reinvests those savings back into effective programs to reduce recidivism, giving us that return on investment and protecting public safety. Out of these guiding principles, we've also developed policy priorities, and this legislation embodies these key features, including judicial discretion, informed decision-making in sentencing, improving sentencing guidelines, reducing recidivism through effective community corrections, and eliminating the need for new prison beds. OBA supports this legislation. It satisfies both our public safety guiding principles and meets our policy priorities, and we urge your support of HB 3194. Thank you.
Questions of the panel? Thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you, and we would wish you well, and you could be back on the dais.
Mm-hmm. Been there, done that.
Smart.
Panel on deck is LaDonna Pollard, Barbara Ross, and Ted Santana.
Co-chairs and member of the committee, my name is Lindsay Nelson, and I'm a domestic violence survivor and an advocate for holistic criminal justice transformation. I'm here to testify today in support of the Oregon Public Safety Package, House Bill 3194. This bill is important to me because I support efforts to update and improve Oregon's public safety system. Oregon can balance holding people who commit crimes accountable while improving our services by investing public safety dollars to improve services for victims of crime, increase community corrections and other public safety efforts, and reinvest in rehabilitation through increased access to mental health and drug treatment services. I have a well-rounded experience that has informed me that this is the best approach. In addition to being a survivor, I've also served as a victim advocate at a district attorney's office, which led me to complete a master's in public administration focused in criminal justice, in which I did my final project specifically around reforming Measure 11. I've worked with offenders at a county community corrections agency, and I now do public policy advocacy. And that is why I think that this is important. As I experienced, anyone, regardless of their ethnicity, socioeconomic status, age, or family support, can be victimized by domestic violence, sexual abuse, stalking, and such crimes. I had the support, and it still occurred to me. It's vital that the person is on the other side of the emergency hotline. The trustworthy hand is there to usher you out of danger and into a safe bed when you feared for your life and sanity one last time. Where does somebody go if they're making one of the 22,000 cries for help that went unmet in 2010? They go back into a home that has now become exponentially more dangerous and imprisoning due to the attempt made to leave. To truly address the safety of the public, we must reinvest in victim services. Victim services are essential to serve victims in the community upfront through providing the hotline, safety planning, and shelter beds. Services in the criminal justice system are also essential to informing victims in a timely and accurate manner amidst the shifting schedules and the long dockets. With the ever-increasing caseloads, these advocates are helping the state comply with the Constitution and informing victims of their right throughout each case. As the Supreme Court made clear in the Barrett case, this is necessary each and every time. Next, these services help survivors rebuild their lives by connecting them to support and resources. There is hope for victims when they are supported to be survivors like myself and others who now thrive and fight to be a voice for those who need a yes for that bed that night. House Bill 3194 has the right balance of ensuring that people who commit a crime are held accountable and makes Oregon smarter on crime by investing a portion of correction savings into victim services and prevention. Ensuring that we have a strong public safety system is a part of creating the safe and strong communities we all want to live in. I thank you for this opportunity to testify. Again, I ask for your support for House Bill 3194 and urge the committee to move this package forward, and happy to answer any questions.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing. I'm the executive director of Mid Valley Women's Crisis Service, and we serve victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking in Marion County. I want to thank all the co-chairs on all their work on this issue. This is so hard, and I have to tell you, I appreciate everyone's work and the Attorney General's work on bringing together panels and all the discussions that have happened. This is hard for me for two reasons. One is I heard the voices of victims and survivors speaking to you tonight, and I know how difficult that is, and my heart goes out to them. And also it's hard for me because our community partners are the District Attorney's Office. They're the community corrections offices, and we appreciate that partnership so much. And what I hope tonight is to talk about some of what I heard last week when you were together, and that was around balance. And what I want to say about that is I sat there and I thought about the reentry programs that are very important, and we support them. But I was in one of those recently where someone got up and spoke about that they had committed 35 crimes, and they were so happy today because they had housing that had been provided for them. They were going to school. They had a mentor. And what I thought about over and over is that every day we work with victims who would love to go back to school, who would love to have housing, and who would love to have a mentor. And all that they have is us. Not every victim goes through the criminal justice system. So part of that balance has to be remembering that there are thousands of victims in your communities who are not going through that system and need the support that only you can give them. We get some funding, some state funding, or the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. That is so crucial to what we do. But every single one of us right now are facing cuts, significant cuts. The sequester, all the different things that you've heard about. and we don't know how we're going to be able to provide services. And I know that some of you know that in our program, we have experienced in the last 3 years almost a doubling of the victims and survivors who are coming to us. We had more than 18,000 contacts to our programs every year over those 3 years. And what I want you to know about that was there were times when we had three or four victims waiting to get help with protection orders, safety planning, because more than 150 individuals in the state of Oregon have been murdered due to domestic violence. We're in a very difficult time, and we need your help to be able to balance that system, to make sure that every time you're thinking about these issues, remember the victim services. Remember that we're there for their voice. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of House Bill 3194. We appreciate your great work on this issue and really support your efforts in moving forward to come up with changes that can preserve a judge's ability to make appropriate accountability decisions while also strengthening the services that Jane spoke about and making sure that every victim in Oregon across the state has access to those life-saving services. As you all know, the Oregon Law Center is a civil legal services provider. We provide free legal services to people across the state. About 40% of our cases are family law cases, and most of those cases, almost all of those cases, involve domestic violence or child abuse. That's how we prioritize cases that we accept. The ones that really need help are the ones that are in crisis. And before I came to work in this building, I spent 10 years practicing family law with a focus on domestic violence cases. And it's from that perspective that I'm here to speak in support of making sure that there is balance in the system and making sure that we continue to think of access to victim services, to safety services for victims, as a critical part of the public safety system. I've come to understand what havoc the crimes of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking can wreak in the lives of our clients. We see those crimes trapping people in poverty, exacerbating their vulnerability, triggering their children into similar cycles, and it's an issue that we have dedicated our time to addressing from a collective community response. And in learning more about that, we have learned that a third of the self-sufficiency cases that our state DHS initiates are as a result of domestic violence, connected to domestic violence. A third of child welfare cases that have been founded where the state is intervening to take steps to protect the child because of violence in the home are as a result of domestic violence. We recently saw a study from the Portland Police Department that showed that 42% of assaults that they respond to are domestic violence-related assaults. And we know that in 2010, which is the most recent statistic we had, one-third of our homicides are domestic violence fatalities. So this is an issue that wreaks havoc in the lives of our clients and our communities and across the state. I know, hearing from our clients as they came in the door to seek services from us, that certainly accountability is important, and we absolutely believe that. But it's not the first thing they said to me when they came through that door. The things that they say coming through that door are, where in the world am I going to sleep tonight? Mm-hmm. How am I going to feed my children? What do I do to try to find ways to get safe moving forward? And so I urge you to keep that in mind as you're moving forward with your discussions and making your decisions about a safety system that is balanced. We know that our communities are stronger when victims and their children are safe, and when they have access to those services. Without funding for services, we are seeing across the state programs having to reduce their ability to help. In Eugene recently, the walk-in center was closed. We recently had the closure of Yolanda House, which is a program in Portland, and it's no longer available. So I urge you to keep that in mind, and I greatly appreciate your attention.
Thank you very much. On deck is David Williams and Deanna Horn.
I'm gonna go first. Okay. Co-chairs and member of the committee, thank you for taking our testimony tonight. I appreciate the. And I commend you for diving into this very tough issue. I'm here today to support your work to make modest changes
you have proposed to Measure 11 and HB 3194. I voted for Measure 11, as did everyone I know. I voted to keep the Ted Bundys, the sexual predators, the I-5 killers off the streets.
Oh, excuse me. Could you say your name for the record?
LaDonna Pollard.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Little did I know the impact this measure would have on our family. Our son, John, worked at Selmet for nearly 20 years before he was convicted of an assault to Measure 11 offense. He was buying a home, had a 401k, paid his taxes, provided health care, food, and all the necessities for a family of four. He asked no help from anyone, often working 60-plus hours a week to make ends meet. He was a good son to us. He is now at OSCI, halfway through a 70-month assault two sentence for a serious jury injury accident on a quad with a young passenger. Our son, at age 36, made some very poor choices to get that sentence. He was at home, at his home, visiting with a longtime friend, and they were drinking. He decided at some point to go for a ride on his quad, taking the little two-year-old with him. When the crash happened, when the quad flipped, Brody was severely injured. He spent a month in the hospital with, I get PTSD when this, I'm sorry. In the hospital, recovering from injuries to the base of his skull and cracked ribs, and watching for potential brain damage. After the quad flip, John called my husband and myself, and we immediately went to his house. I was shocked. Amid the chaos, I asked John to please go to the hospital and get the medical attention that he required, because he had a fist-size chunk of his calf hanging on by a tendon and a thread of skin. He refused to leave until Brody was cared for and on his way to help. We believe in accountability. Thank you. Oh. On many occasions, my kids refer to me as Judge Judy because of my intolerance of crime. I'm not kidding. Our son made a horrible choice, and there should have been consequences for their actions. The reason we're here today is to say that Measure 11 went too far in this instance. 2 or 3 years in prison would have been sufficient and appropriate for our son. Even Brody's mother said she didn't want this for John. The DA absolutely refused to consider a lesser charge of assault 3, which John said he deserved and was ready to step up to the plate. But not this, not 70 months. The judge in our case appeared that she didn't want to impose a sentence, but she had no choice. Another huge complication of this assault to conviction that is very, very serious is that it includes an 8-year post-prison release with no driver's license. Now, my son has a job waiting for him when he gets out of prison. He will have no way to get to this job, to pay restitution, to attend AA, to take care of his family if he doesn't have a driver's license. It's a clear indication to us that the way this measure is written complicates and prevents these prisoners from succeeding when they get released. He has used the opportunity through the prison system for education for his alcohol abuse. He struggled with addiction for several years, though he remained a functional alcoholic. I just want to say, how much is this costing the state of Oregon? When John was taken to prison, his ex-wife immediately applied for and received state aid, food stamps, welfare, health care. One granddaughter lives with us. The other granddaughter lives with our daughter. Can I finish? Just finish real quick. Thank you.
Barbara will share her time.
I know this lady. There are other prisoners with the same issues as our sons, who would be absolutely no danger, a threat to society. If they were released this minute, they would be working, supporting their families, and paying restitution. I think it's also important to say that our family has been on both sides of the fence where crime issues are concerned. Our daughter, Shelley, was a domestic abuse and sexual assault victim in her 20s. She is now a drug and alcohol counselor, using her experiences to make a difference. I have a niece who was hit by a drug.
Caller, I am going to ask you, because I don't, okay, everybody else will want to go on. If you have written testimony, we can get copies and you can share with
I do. Thank you. Thank you. Please read, guys.
And do thank you for sharing. All right, Barbara.
Thank you very much. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Ross, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters, which is a nonpartisan grassroots volunteer group that has long supported community corrections programs. I really do want to compliment the members of the committee and the co-chairs for the tremendous amount of research and background work that you have already done on this complicated issue. And you've done all that homework, you've read the stuff, you've heard the testimony, and so in the next few weeks, it's going to be time to act. It's time to take the bull by the horns and make decisions. And it really boils down to this. It boils down to having nonviolent and less dangerous criminals spend shorter periods of time in prison, use that money that you would have spent for that extra time, invest it in community corrections program that you know works. You have the research, you know it works, but you can't have sloppy programs. You have to do those programs right or you won't get the results that you expect. And if you're going to have community corrections programs, transition programs at work, they have to have several things. One is they have to have good assessments. You have to really assess what that individual offender needs. Does he need alcohol treatment? Does he need prescriptions for mental health? Does he need job search skills? Does he need cognitive retraining? Does he need to get quit rationalizing and blaming everybody else for his problems? We know how to do those programs. The research has showed it, and we know how to do it, but we have to do them right. So you have to have those positive programs, and the communities have to have the resources in order to make them work. And management has to be looking over the shoulders of the staff, be sure that the staff has the training, and be sure that management is insisting on really quality evaluations to make sure that, in fact, those programs are working and that they're working as advertised and you get the results that you need. These choices are not going to be easy for you. It's tough to do this stuff, but you have to go back to the data, what works, what reduces crime in the community, what reduces recidivism, and so you're going to have to do some tough things. You're going to need to give more prisoners opportunities for earned time so that they get that motivation. You're going to have to give judges more flexibility, and you're going to have to make sure that communities, community corrections have the resources and the motivation to do high-quality transition programs so the people who've offended before, done bad things before, are less likely to do them in the future, and we keep the public safer. We thank you for all your work. This is going to be a tough set of decisions. It's not easy, but looking around, you guys are really smart folks, and you're up to it. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, and the League of Women Voters appreciates your service.
Oh. On deck is Gary Griffin and Allison McIntosh.
You didn't bite anybody else, so I guess you won't bite me. No. Good evening, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Deanna Horn. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I work at Metropolitan Public Defender's Office in Portland. I have a friendly face right there in front of me. Mr. Nasby and I used to work together. I'm here to tell you the story of a family. I'm here to tell you the story of a family that I had the opportunity to work with. As you've heard already this evening, stories in the criminal justice system are always stories that involve families. I met Monique when she was 16 years old. She was in custody in Multnomah County's juvenile justice facility. She was charged with a ballot measure 11 assault in the second degree. She had a 14-year-old brother. She had an iPod, and those of you who have raised teenagers in the same house might see where this is going. There was a scuffle over the iPod. Monique's younger brother had made fun of her choices of music, and she took offense to that, and as teenagers do, a scuffle ensued. In the middle of the scuffle, Monique grabbed a lightweight candlestick off the table and bapped her brother in the head, creating a small lump. And I actually, when I picked up this case, I had to call my sister and ask her how many times I'd smacked her in the head with something when we grew up, and neither of us could remember how often that had happened. Now, Monique's mother was a really distressed single parent. She'd been concerned for many years that Monique had had some significant mental health issues that weren't being addressed in the community, and she called people, and she called people, and she begged for help for her child. And the response she got was, well, when things get bad, if you call the police, we'll put her in the juvenile justice system, and then she can get the help that she needs, and it will be fine. Well, when she saw the scuffle between her children, and she thought, aha, here's my opportunity to get my child some help, the police showed up, put her in handcuffs, sent their police reports to the district attorney's office, who charged Monique in adult court with an assault too, where she faced 70 months in prison. Now, she was in custody for about 8 months. She did some time at the children's farm home because, yes, she needed some mental health care. Her mother was right. This distressed her brother, and it tore this family apart. If there had been a judge who had had the discretion to look at the facts of this case and to say, this young woman needs the help that her mother was promised, she needs to be in the juvenile justice system, she would have received that help. She wouldn't be on adult probation now. And we would have saved an enormous amount of money. And we would have helped that family. But we didn't do it.
Ms. Tui?
Madam Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Dave Williams. I'm Vice President of Utility Services at Northwest Natural. But more importantly for this evening's discussion, I'm Chair of the Citizens Crime Commission. I'm here today in support of the Oregon Public Safety Package contained in House Bill 3194. We join other business associations in supporting public safety reform as a part of the business plan to help grow Oregon's economy by making wise investments of our public dollars. For two decades, the Citizens Crime Commission has brought a business perspective to public safety, policy, and practices. We have worked closely with government officials, criminal justice professionals, and lawmakers to make Oregon State and local communities safer. During that time, we have seen a lot of success in crime reduction thanks to policy decisions investing scarce resources in the right places. But we are also aware of troubling trends in our state that threaten to erode the headway we're making towards safer communities. While I'm not an expert in corrections policy, our board has followed the work of the Governor's Public Safety Commission made up of experts and appreciate their comprehensive examination of the data and trends in corrections. Their report highlights the strength of Oregon's public safety system. We have generally used our prisons for violent crimes and sex offenders. But the report also highlights the unmistakable trend towards using more of our prison beds for persons convicted of nonviolent offenses. That trend has implications for our state's investments in other more cost-effective alternatives that are proven to reduce crime. The Public Safety Commission report and the House Bill 3194 provides a well-reasoned, balanced roadmap for evidence-based reform that will alter this trend. Without action at this time, the state faces a projected growth of prison beds over the next decade that will require building a new prison at a total cost of $600 million. This problem is not going away. If the state maintains current policies and practices towards funding prisons, it threatens programs and efforts that have a proven track record of reducing recidivism and improving public safety. We support investing those public safety dollars towards police, victim services, community corrections, and evidence-based treatment for addictions and mental illness that feed criminal behavior. We support fine-tuning Oregon's sentencing and corrections policy to get our state's public safety system back on track, and we also support a common-sense, balanced approach contained in House Bill 3194. We believe such reforms will deliver accountability, justice, and a better return on Oregon's public safety dollars. For that, I appreciate your support, and thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
On deck is Ted Smetana and Leland Berger.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Griffin. I'm a member of Phoenix Rising Transitions and a leader with Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good in Portland. I'm here to urge you to support House Bill 3194. This bill will cut prison costs and create savings that can be reinvested in community-based reentry programs like mentoring. These important programs increase the likelihood that a person will live a crime-free life after prison, but they are woefully underfunded. A strong reentry program has been very important in my own transition. I've been home for 33 days, and I am one of a fortunate few who have mentor support through Phoenix Rising Transitions. This is the second time I've been released from prison. The first time was in 2006. I was paroled with nothing and to nothing. Most Oregon counties have few, if any, transitional services programs. When I paroled to Lane County, there wasn't much beyond short-term housing. I was lucky enough to find work immediately, but it was seasonal tree work, and when the weather got bad, the work dried up. I felt hopeless. Faced with desperate need and no support system, I went right back to my old ways, and before long, I was back in jail and on my way to the penitentiary. This time, I worked for over a year with Phoenix Rising Transitions Community Inreach while still in prison. I learned new skills in their nonviolent communication class that have helped me in all areas of my life. In their leadership class, I was mentored by others who had been in prison as well. I was deeply encouraged by the changes I saw in them. This provided an opening for change to occur in me. I sought success by surrounding myself with the success of others who had walked my path. Through Phoenix and the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good, I also formed meaningful relationships with people in the community. Something I had never thought possible. Relating to community members and those who succeeded in breaking their own criminal cycle opened a door for me. This time, I came home as a hopeful citizen rather than a hopeless ex-con. Now I have two Phoenix mentors that I see several times a week. I'm attending Portland Community College and volunteering with the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good to make positive changes in my community. Oregon needs more community-based alternatives to incarceration, and it needs to fund vital reentry work like mentoring. House Bill 3194 will allow more public safety dollars to be directed toward these programs that better prepare people for life in the community. And it will go a long way toward creating safer communities because mentoring is about changing lives. Thank you for your time.
Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chairs, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. The Human Services Coalition of Oregon is a coalition of organizations across Oregon, all concerned about the future of our state and the health and dignity of all Oregonians. We know the importance of supportive services to keep our neighbors and communities healthy, and today we're here to support House Bill 3194 because we support efforts to improve and strengthen our public safety system. Today, the state of Oregon is spending increasing amounts on prisons while cutting funding for victim services and addictions and mental health treatment. Too many people are turned away while seeking safety from domestic violence, and too many people with mental health conditions go untreated. States around the country are moving to reform their correction systems because research shows that there are more cost-effective approaches to public safety than having a heavy reliance on incarceration. Incarceration is the most expensive public safety tool we have, and we need to use it more strategically. The Human Services Coalition of Oregon knows there are many things we can do to help create a more balanced approach to public safety. We believe that improvements to our public safety system now will help realign our priorities for the future. Those include investing in critical victim services, mental health treatment, drug and alcohol treatment, and other crime prevention strategies, such as investments in community corrections. Over the long term, these investments will help create better and stronger communities. House Bill 3194 and its reforms to sentencing laws is the right approach. This smart on crime approach to reform is more effective and less costly way to improve public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control corrections costs. Reinvestments of savings into crime prevention strategies and victim services is a critical part of the plan to create the safe and strong communities we all want to live in. The Human Services Coalition of Oregon is in support of House Bill 3194 and reinvestment in critical services. We know this approach will help create safer and healthier communities and will help more Oregonians access the critical services they need. We thank you so much for your work on this important issue and for your service to our state.
Thank you for your testimony. While they're coming up, is there anyone that I did not call up who signed up? Yeah. You want to?
Lee Berger.
Lee Berger? Yeah, I called you. You didn't hear me.
You're up. Come on.
You're up. Come on up. Is there anyone else that didn't hear?
Or didn't sign up.
Or didn't sign up? Okay. You're going to bring it home.
Okay. Good evening, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Ted Smetana. I'm the director of the Yamhill County Community Corrections Department. And I provided you written testimony, but rather than kind of rehash that, I am definitely in support of House Bill 3194. I thought I would augment that testimony with a little bit of just about a local story on how this bill would affect our operations and also our funding. I think it's pretty widely known that community corrections funding has been cut pretty dramatically. I think the current biennium we saw a 20% reduction, 8% the biennium before, and that doesn't even count the fact that at least in my county, every year our cost of going business goes up by about 6%. So you see we've been struggling. And in context of the funding and of the reinvestment concepts, I've mentioned before to you that we have been participating with the National Institute of Corrections on a project to implement evidence-based decision-making throughout our local criminal justice system, from arrest all the way through discharge from supervision, involving all the agencies that are represented. And we focused on three main areas, and the first I'll mention is correctional programs. We've really restructured our programs. We've put much more focus on cognitive and motivational programs so that people can benefit in that way, but then later benefit from substance abuse, sex offense, sex offender, or batterers intervention programs by increasing their motivation and reducing their criminal thinking. And we're also making sure that we're assessing every individual to see if they need those programs. And what we're going to see very soon, I predict, is a very increased need. Our capacity is going to rise. And today, as it stands, I have no funding to boost those services. So this funding potentially could be very helpful in that regard. The second is evidence-based sentencing. I have testified before about how we developed a system to assess people using a battery of assessments and then provide that information to the court prior to sentencing. In terms of this potential incentive program, where counties would be offered some funds to reduce prison commitments per year by 6%, prison months imposed. That process, I think, will fit right in. It will help us determine who's eligible for a possible diversion or a shorter sentence, and just as importantly, it will help us locally define who's not appropriate for that, someone who is high risk and not amenable to supervision and shouldn't be considered for any kind of a lesser sentence. And our third area is pretrial release. I know it's outside the concept of 3194, but we've been working very hard to introduce evidence-based practices into pretrial justice in our county. We've implemented risk tools so that we can actually have an actuarial risk assessment of whether this person will likely appear in court or whether they will likely offend while on pretrial release status. And what this potential incentive funding can do is actually provide us funding for that service, even though it's beyond the scope of 3194. Incentive fundings could be used for that purpose. Thank you very much.
Good evening, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I've been practicing for 30 years this month, which means that I am old enough to have tried cases with Keith Meisenheimer when he was a prosecutor advising his complainants that they had a voice, and that I am, but mostly now I represent medical marijuana patients and their providers statewide, so I get to appear in court with Bracken McKee and his jihad on the distribution of medical cannabis in Washington County. So this, my presentation, I think, will be a little different from the rest of the presentations. I'm not here to talk about Measure 11, which I opposed, and I was one of the team of lawyers in Multnomah County that worked on constitutional arguments for what was an incredibly poor policy choice that the people made. I'm here to talk about some of the technical provisions regarding the increase in the definition of substantial quantity for marijuana for the felony sentencing guidelines. And I had testified about this on a similar bill in the House before Representative Barker and the House Judiciary Committee, so I apologize for those who have to hear that part of it twice. But we especially appreciate the increase in the definition of substantial quantity from 150 grams to a kilogram, which is 1,000 grams, almost eightfold increase. And we think that that ought to be instructive for a bill I testified on first thing this morning before Senator Przanski and the Judiciary Committee on, I guess, on Monday or Tuesday, the Senate Bill 40, which has the opportunity to create, and Senator Roblin has the opportunity to create a misdemeanor. Currently, Oregon law provides less than an ounce of marijuana is a violation, more than an ounce is a felony, and more than 150 grams is a substantial quantity, which means if it's a delivery or manufacturing case, then it's a presumptive prison sentence. It shouldn't be that way. There ought to be a misdemeanor marijuana provision, and I'm hopeful that the Senate Judiciary Committee will work through that. I understand, though, that these provisions aren't regarding the increase in substantial quantity and the various rankings of it, aren't reflective of the fact that you've heard all these stories tonight about alcohol and the ravages that have caused families and the crime that it's caused, and not a single story about marijuana and the, and it being a public safety problem, because it's not a public safety problem. The what is a problem is that people are continuing to be imprisoned for it, and I understand, again, that these proposals have to do with reducing the cost, and there's an opportunity, instead of reducing the cost, to make income producing, to create an income stream, and I know Representative Barker and the Senate Judiciary Committee referred to House Revenue, the 3371 for legalization. So I'm here on behalf of Compassionate Oregon to tell you that we support increasing the substantial quantity from 150 grams to a kilogram and putting that at level 4 in the category 5 of a kilogram to 5 kilograms and reducing delivery to a minor from a presumptive prison sentence to a presumptive probation sentence at level 6. But it is just wrong. It is just wrong to have a marijuana offenses listed at level 8, 9, and 10, which are offenses, which are crime severity levels for homicides and for attempted murder. It's just wrong. No presumptive prison for pot. That's the message I wanted to leave you with tonight, and I hope that you'll consider making those technical changes to it. Otherwise, looks to be good, comprehensive legislation. I thank you very much, as always, for allowing me to testify before you. Thanks.
Thank you. And are there any questions? Hearing none. Thank you all for your patience and your courtesy of sticking to mostly, mainly, your time limits. You can tell that I do budgets because I calculated how much time it would take us to get finished.
In 2 hours.
In 2 hours, and if there's no question, we are adjourned.
And I have a 7 o'clock one this morning.